This is Richard Jones, and I'm the bass player on this record.
Which one are you?
And that was Jeff, who's the drummer.
I'm Root, I play guitar and wrote some of the tunes.
And I'm Belinda, except that I may be called Bindi on there. I need to have a look. And I played fiddle, and I played keyboards, and I played recorder, and I sang a little bit.
I'm Nick Pallett, and I'm the lead singer, and I played a little bit of acoustic guitar too.
I'm David Jones, and I'm not on the album at all.
Oh,
I wrote some of the words, and I used to play percussion.
Which words did you write?
Oh God, Saccharine Lady. The thing about a ship sinking and a hole, with a hole in its arse. I actually wrote that line.
And where did you get that story from?
I got that. I was thinking whether I've got that at home. I might have that, and we could put it on the website if I can find it. It was an ancient newspaper I found somewhere. I don't know whether it was an original or a facsimile. Anyways, it's just this story, and it inspired me the way it does. I don't know, something about a ship that went down, and they were all going to sink, and this band came up and rescued them.
A band?
Yeah. I can't remember the story exactly. I mean, I haven't read the bloody words, you know, because the words I wrote. But it was something to do with a band turned up and sort of said, everybody calm down by playing music, and that created order out of chaos, and everybody got
to... I'm not mistaken, this for Titanic, are you?
Could be.
No, the band will obviously be firing in their spare time, so they've got all the skills.
The bit I like on that track is the bit where it sounds like fife and drums.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of bolero or something, isn't it?
It is a bolero.
It is very dramatic.
That's where the rhythm came from.
Oh, right.
It's a rip-off of Ravel.
Yes.
That pattern.
We ripped off Ravel earlier as well, didn't we?
Whose idea was it?
Oh, we did. It was Left-Handed Piano Concerto. Left-Handed Piano Concerto, yes. That's right, yes. Very good rock riff that Ravel wrote in his heyday. It was a pianist who lost his right arm.
So it suits guitarists, doesn't it?
Really? Yeah, absolutely.
You can play with your left hand, really, don't you?
Speak for yourself, mate.
But you know, this whole thing of lyrics really interests me, you see, on this. I mean, what I'd like to know, because I never used to listen to the words at all. I mean, words to me are just a way of getting the notes of the tune out.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think the tunes are really hard. We were just talking about this, weren't we, Nick? The tunes are really difficult to sing. So, I mean, how do you go from getting, you know, a tune like, I don't know, Assassin Senorita, say, to actually getting some words?
Well, I think the process is really interesting, because Richard and Root used to come up with these tunes, and I think you had the first go at them, David. Mm-hmm. And what happens? I mean, you just try to capture the mood of the music. I mean, I I think, yeah, your stuff, Dave, is really clever and it tells stories and it's very literate. If you listen to the stuff I wrote, I mean, listening to it now 30 years later, I think it sounds like, it sounds very drug-induced. It sounds like we're all on substances. Double-jointed, for example, I mean, it sounds like, I mean, the music to me sounds like a bloody opium den or something. So, you know, just try to capture the mood of the feel of the music and just see what comes. And you can't explain the process. Something peculiar feeling.
Sometimes it started with two things. I remember Assassin Eureta was a...
Is it all one word?
It was, yeah, it was two words joined together into one.
Festival of Sibilance.
And I think that came from you, yeah. I think Richard came up with a combination of notes and words and said, see if you can write... Something.
Yeah, not on that. That's a root tune.
All right. Well,
the funny thing is, you know,
second lady,
yeah.
Didn't I?
Yeah.
Anyway, it was a question of just taking a phrase and trying to develop a story around. You know, what comes to mind that goes with this music, which chimes in the mood, as Nick said.
Prior to this one, which we never did any theatrics for, at other times someone had some kind of idea of a theatre piece that we were going to do, didn't they?
I think that's the point, isn't it?
Yes.
That when listening to all that stuff, you've got to understand that the band had this visual...
Had a theme.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's not necessarily with this set, but certainly the one before, the idea, wasn't it, that there was going to be something going on stage... Mm. That would be visual,
yeah,
and that obviously
made
the words.
And choreography and some sort of narrative.
Yeah, which characters,
meant,
yeah, so, yeah.
Which meant that the songs were sort of expanded out of the normal kind of rock song, get your kit off, kind of idea.
Yeah.
That's what I was going to ask you, though, Nick, actually, was that I wondered, because you did a load of writing when we were down in that farmhouse, and I just wondered if you had any visual ideas. At that time, were you already thinking about things you might have done on stage? Because I don't remember thinking about any of that at that time, but I wondered if you were, because you were writing words.
No, I didn't. I was saying you, because I was just totally concentrating and focusing on the music and the lyrics.
Right.
And
so that would have come
trying
later.
To get all the words to fit the tunes, and there was no concept at all of anything.
Because in the past it had been the other way around,
yeah.
Didn't it?
Mm, yeah.
And I'm not quite sure how it all came about when I think about it.
Think we were paying.
Did the lyrics always come to the music? The music always came first, though, didn't it?
No, both places.
Did you sometimes have lyrics on their own? I don't remember that. Like, can you think of any?
Well, I think that's exactly what we were talking about earlier, Scarlet Hoffman. I'm almost sure I wrote that as if it was writing a poem.
It's possible, yeah.
I never did actually write them as
well.
Well,
certainly in the very early days of the band, way before this, I mean, some of the first songs were written by actually setting existing poems to music, which is a completely different sort of discipline.
Mm.
That's right, that did tend to happen
at the very beginning.
In the first band, whereas with this band, it tended to be the music first.
Mm. Yeah. Mm.
But that's... very often there would, a visual idea would spark off an idea for music, and then the words would be the last thing in line. Mm. So it was either music first, and then visuals, and then words, or the other way around.
But even though, you know, when the band went out on the road, it was like a 2-hour set, wasn't it? We used to play we used to play for a long time. Played for a long time, and a lot of that would have, you know, visual stuff to it. Mm. They tend to be restricted around one song, didn't they? Except, I mean, I can think of Glass White Gangster, that was an extended piece.
Yes.
That lasted, what, 20 minutes?
Something
like that. Yeah. But we definitely went in with this idea of making an extended piece there. And we thought, oh, you know, we can put a bit in here which gives us some dancing. Yeah. And we can do a reprise on it and stuff like that, didn't we? Mm-hmm. I don't think we were doing that on this, were we? I mean, it was going to come later.
Yeah, no, it's just odd songs, an album. Isn't it?
Oh, this was all about songs, yeah.
Thinking about an album.
Getting something down that might keep us alive for a bit longer.
In fact, the only one really that had a theme to start with, surely, was the Asmodo, wasn't it? Because wasn't that the idea from the very beginning with that one? I can't think of any other... music.
I mean, that's sort of half an album that's sort of all kind of around a theme, isn't it? But
the theme came first because of the boulders down the hill.
Yes, probably.
Whereas I think with everything else, it just sort of came at the same time. It was just gradually, you know, knit together, perhaps.
It's the mysteries of the creative process, isn't it? Where does it come from?
Like, we were always into complexity, weren't we?
Yeah,
it was never a band who was trying to play straight-ahead rock music, was it? You know, so anyone who criticised it for not playing straight-ahead rock music wasn't getting it to me, because that was never the intention. Mm. And I think a lot of people pigeonhole the band, either from memory or when they hear some of the material now, they pigeonhole it as a kind of hippy-drippy psychedelic band, missing the point that it was never really the intention right from the beginning, and even through this record, it was never the intention to play kind of this kind of music or that kind of music, but to create each song, to create each piece in its own right, according to how you felt it needed to be. So in a sense, the kind of eclecticism and variety was the whole point of the enterprise.
Plus having different writers, of course, makes it like that anyway. Mm. Although often we always thought, well, didn't we think that the most successful ones were where you really had that fusion of writing? Yeah. And I do remember that we thought Glass White Gangster was really good because of that. It became something else because of the two.
Well, that's because it kind of... we had a couple of musical things, but actually we put it all together in rehearsal. Mm-hmm. It actually grew out of
that. That's true.
Mind you, I think these did as well. And I think, you know, that was the really big thing, that having Pete White in the band. I mean, he was... I think we'd agree, wouldn't we? I mean, technically, as you know, on his instrument, he was much better than any of us.
He was a pretty clever chap. Yeah.
Yeah. And I thought that I think that's what he brought. I think we had obviously as a band, we had a lot. We had an originality and we had a lot of creativity. But what he did with his playing was he gave us a real solidity.
Yeah. Also, he was quick, wasn't he?
Very quick, and so you got this kind of virtuoso playing that enabled us to be as clever as we liked with all the other stuff, because it kind of held it all together.
You could actually bring it off.
It's a shame that this was all happening when mini moogs were the height of fashion.
But we'd already started this kind of music. I mean, we'd done the Round One stuff, and I think we were all a bit disappointed with the way it turned out in the studio. because it didn't sound as good, did it, as when we played it live.
It didn't have the punch.
It didn't have
the vitality.
And we've actually got some tapes of us in rehearsal. Well,
I think that's some technical mystery, because I don't think it's in the playing. Because I mean,
it kind of just got smoothed out somehow, yes. Didn't it? But you can hear in round one, especially like in Glass White Gangster, kind of where we were going to go to, because it had started having that real spiky edge to it. Where the earlier band had been, it was a bit more folky, wasn't it?
There were a bit more folky bits, weren't there?
Yeah, and we were turning into a kind of really hard edge, spiky, quite aggressive sounding rock band.
It's aggressive, yeah.
And this one. You know, I'm just looking down the list here. Things like The Beast, Saccharine Lady, Assassin Senorita, Helix, those ones in particular, to me sound like our idea of kind of stadium rock or something, you know. But, you know, it's hard hitting and it's.
Prog.
Well, no, yeah. I mean,
if I can use that word.
It is a great shame that we never had the chance to record it properly.
Yeah.
Because there is some fantastic music on there. And, you know, I mean, like for me, you know, the poor old drummer, you know, when you're trying to record a set of drums on a stone floor in the kitchen, you know, the farmhouse kitchen with one mic.
I mean, can anyone remember exactly how we did this technically? Did we have the mixing desk in there?
No, we had an old Sony reel to reel quarter inch.
Yeah, but did we have like more than one mic and mixed it down into a two track?
Off a desk? No, I think
we recorded the band on one side of the tape. And
with how many mics?
Completely one mic. Us three standing around one mic where we were doing harmonies. Maracas. all went on one track.
Yeah,
so it was a two-track recording.
And of course, we made absolutely no consideration at all about whether it was in your pitch, your singing.
It was very low to very high.
We just
thought, use technical
look, terms. We've written this in E. I can play it in E, so you can sing it in E.
I think this was always the way, though, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
Do I do every singer's complaint all the way along?
It's good for them. Character building. It stretches and develops the instrument.
When you record, you see properly, you have to spend as much time on the vocals as you do doing the backing tracks.
Only if you're the first take.
Yes. But the first take's always the best anyway. Whether to sing falsetto or whether to scream and sound like a strangled chicken, the choice.
The vocal lines are sort of part of the musical arrangement.
Mm. Is there anything you would change? Mm. If you know any little bits that you would change?
Yeah, I'd change the bit where we didn't really get paid very much. I'd change that by quite a bit.
You change the moods.
I'd change the bloody mini moods because I hate that horrible farting Barbie sound. Sound like mini moods. Yeah.
But at the time,
that was the new world of sonic possibility.
It was, and just using it was quite exciting because it actually made you appreciate the sounds.
We thought we were frightfully modern.
That's what we were. We had twice the tuning problem.
You did have to think. It was the first time I'd appreciated how a sound was made. You know, the attack and the decay.
Yeah,
and
but it wasn't worth it, was it?
Because I was sitting there twiddling these knobs, thinking, I'm going to make this sound.
It's just that mini moogs are specific sound, isn't it?
Well, they are.
But that might be worth clarifying the fact that you are playing keyboards and Peter's playing keyboards. And Peter's playing guitar and Rick's playing guitar. And Nick's playing some acoustic guitar, I think. There's all that stuff going on, isn't there?
Yes.
It's hard to decipher who's playing what, actually, but there is quite a lot of them.
And there were a whole bunch of keyboards around, weren't we? Did he have a Hammond?
Yeah, he had a Hammond.
And you had a kind of Haven that had various sounds on it. Yeah. And two moves which you could play monophonically.
Yeah.
You've got an advantage here. Richard's holding the CD, cutting things from it. Yeah, I keep trying to snatch it from him and failing. I was just going to have a look. We could all have a little look.
This is the CD, the Devon tapes. You are listening to.
You are listening to.
I like the one that you sing, that Belinda sings.
Five Old Gits and Belinda.
There was a case in point, I'm afraid. It was so high for my voice, I just couldn't sing it. No, it was a strain, though. Which is a pity, because actually it was nice to sing.
I really like the mandolin on there. The mandolin and violin.
Yes.
The tune is really unusual. The tunes that are going on, I've never quite understood them. I can't. The structure. Actually, I'm talking to Root here, and the idea of Root with musical structure is always an odd one because the structures are always very peculiar.
It does actually sound as if there's more instruments than there are, doesn't it? Because it's got a quite complex counterpoint.
Sounds like a bit of Haydn, doesn't it?
It's quite classical.
Yeah, he should be. He should be Haydn after playing that.
I'll seek an initial find.
But there was a tradition, wasn't there, of you playing that kind of, you know, mandolin?
Well, that's probably refers back to the earlier days, wasn't it, when there were more folk.
Well, and on round one.
Yeah.
Mrs. O'Reilly.
Yeah. Again, a bit of variety, a bit of eclecticism.
Best song.
I mean, you weren't just the Whizmore kid.
No, thank goodness for that, yeah.
You were also a fake hero.
And this was the other question, Root. How on earth did you ever think of the Whizmore kid?
Where did that come from?
I don't.
You should be ashamed of yourself.
I don't know. To be quite honest, I don't know. I think it was just an idea of a character that chased around like crazy without knowing what day of the week it was. The sort of visual idea for the sort of strange, the sort of helmet. The first version was more a sort of egg shaped helmet rather than the later versions, which were more sort of. Tended to pull towards the American football type, but the original thing actually came from looking at some photographs by Cecil Beaton taken in Japan, and it came from some kind of traditional costume or drama. Someone with a kind of egg shaped helmet on their head, and that for some reason that connected up with the other idea for the thing, and so I made the first helmet in the traditional Blue Peter way by blowing up a balloon and slapping papier-mâché on it, bursting the balloon, and then cutting a hole to stick my head in. So it's sophisticated stuff, show business on a shoestring.
Then what about the wheel up front?
Oh yeah, then it had a little wheel that
it developed, didn't it? And then it got the wings. All I remember was, I mean, you know, suddenly in the middle of a rehearsal, you just vanished somewhere. I thought you'd gone off to have a roll of fag or something, and then all of a sudden, you leapt in playing the Whizmore Kid, which we kind of had heard before, dressed up. All our faces. Well, our mouths just dropped, a bit like it did with the audience, you know.
But who called it the Whizmore Kid? You?
It was me, yeah. I thought, you know, Whizmore Kid. I thought it was a little concept there.
Yes. Based on a Japanese new play.
Well,
Cecil Beaton's.
No, it's just a visual thing. It's based on bitter personal experiences. Some kind which we don't need to go into.
It struck a chord, didn't it?
Well, it was a bit of a laugh, I think, it's fair to say, yes.
We'd have some music. We'd then think, Bendy would go off and sew some bits of plastic together and make costumes and things. And Nick and Bendy would go off and organ, learn a dance.
Learn a dance routine.
Can we still do it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but on the other hand, if we don't have had a bit more money, then yeah. I think perhaps we could have concentrated on being a band and hired people in to do the to do the theatricals.
But we tried that sort of. We tried it with the costumes, and they were a disaster. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have the original Doris the Dinosaur sitting with us. We're very honoured.
I'd forgotten
that. And Doris the Dinosaur worked far better when it was an old Millet sleeping bag.
US Army sleeping bag.
From when we actually paid some poncy designer to make one out of foam rubber, which then completely fell apart and was a waste of time.
And speaking as the motive power for the said duck, you were inside looking through a slit the size of a mosquito, blundering around on the stage, cold of complex electronic equipment, drums and people, and had an edge with with a drop and an audience. You can see a thing,
yeah.
And it was really, really dangerous, and I just used to fall over and try to be comical, because the best thing to do was stay where you were and wave your legs around.
And I think we were better at kind of being self-sufficient, all the visuals were done, well, they weren't done by me, because I could never bring myself to doing it. You know, the expanding hands and the revolving doors, and anybody who wasn't there isn't going to understand
it. It's the stuff of legend. You have to be there.
The one that always kills me is, we had this pyrotechnics in me. We had this sea maroon, which is like the biggest bang in the world, which was the climax of the Glass White Gangster Show.
And which was set inside a water system.
Cast iron water.
With a microphone on it.
Fancy having to carry that around in your
bag. That's right. The biggest bang.
And we had this elaborate electronic set, didn't we, that David, you had, didn't you, next to your bunch of stuff, with lots of different switches and to do various things throughout the show, and a big red button to set off this maroon. That's right, isn't it? And the first time I think that we did this show, and because when we took a new show out on the road, it was prone to disaster, wasn't it? And pretty difficult to do. And I think it was Newcastle University or something like that. And as we went through the set, the crowd thinned out. Because I don't think they really understood. And then some people started heckling us. And we were all thinking, well, we're going to really get them in a minute, because we're going to set off this huge bang. And the music built and built and built. And we got louder and louder. And we got up to this big point. And David pressed the red button, and of course, fuck all that. And we just went, oh shit, and just put down our instruments and just walked off stage.
Well, it was a kind of dry run for the Millennium Lights, wasn't it?
As opposed to when we played Leeds Town Hall, which was that one we played when we played with Roxy Music, where I don't think they like following us really.
That was the Leeds bus garage.
Yeah, and it's a bus garage, an old bus garage, wasn't the town hall, that's right. Enormous place.
Yeah.
And we thought, we're never going to fill this, with our bang. So we decided to put two maroons in this bath. And of course, the bloody place had an enormous echo and everything. And every time we played, there would always be some idiot who would come and sit on this tank.
That's not an idiot, that's a fan.
I beg your pardon. It's like people would always sit with their head inside the PA, wouldn't they? And there was always somebody who came, and I would wander over, because we'd all pretend, that we didn't know what was coming, wouldn't we, when we were playing. And I wandered over and said, you don't want to sit there, mate. And he just looked at me, with that look, so I thought, suit yourself. And anyway, the thing went off, and we primed down, because we had our own lights as well, so the bang went off, and all the lights went off, and it was the loudest bang you've ever heard. And it sounded like, there'd have been a proper bomb or something, and the lights went off, and people started to scream.
Yeah. And we knew it was coming, so we were dancing, but we put our fingers in our ears just at the crucial moment. Because we knew there was a really big bang coming.
Yeah, a lot of health and safety issues in rock and roll.
God, what about those blooming tambourine juice to throw into the audience.
Oh yeah,
I mean they were just killers.
Yeah.
Why we didn't damage people?
Yeah. Well, we did once, yeah. And we cut somebody with one.
Not surprised.
And yeah, before every gig, then
we had to get the pliers and sit there. And how many were we going to throw out? 30 or whatever. We had to sit with them with pliers. Screwing up, what would you call it? Pressing all the nails.
Pliering
all the nails down in the tambourines, and checking it with our fingers each one. That's okay.
Because they're from China or something, about a penny each.
I used to do it on my own. Used to be down the pub. I used to do it on my own, just in my room on my own.
We were busy writing tunes, weren't we? And,
well, I'm drinking beer.
Chatting with the fans.
Mm. Yeah. Anyway, anyone got anything else to say?
My favourite lyric is "Help me, you bastards, is here in my room."
From the
end of Helix, it just finishes.
Help me, you bastards! No, it's not that one. How does it go? Sing it. Help me, you bastards, is here in my room.